President Trump says he made a perfect call to Ukraine's president, asking him to do us a favor. But in Ukraine, there's a long backstory to it.
You know, so many parts of Trump world intersect with Ukraine. It's actually kind of crazy.
I'm Marco Werman. We'll hear all about that backstory. Also today, 1 year since the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. A friend of his says a Saudi journalist was a critic, but not an enemy.
He was being critical for the sake of Saudi Arabia, not against Saudi Arabia.
And in South Korea, karaoke culture is still a thing. But that's changing because of new workplace laws. Also, a doctor and former NFL player helping out in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Spare a thought for Finland's president. Sauli Niinistö was at the White House today to meet President Trump, but the visit was overshadowed by this.
They've been trying to impeach me from the day I got elected. I've been going through this for 3 years. They've been trying to impeach me from the day I got elected. And you know what? They failed. And this is the easiest one of all.
In what was supposed to be a joint news conference, Trump gave a lengthy defense of his July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president. He said it was a perfect call. Democrats say that conversation is a smoking gun, proof that Trump has betrayed his oath of office. But when it comes to Ukraine, this story is about more than one phone call. Ilya Marritz is on the line with me now. He's a co-host of WNYC Studios podcast, Trump, Inc. He says Donald Trump's connections to Ukraine go way back.
You know, so many parts of Trump world intersect with Ukraine. It's actually kind of crazy. I think the most famous bit would be Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort worked for a Ukrainian strongman. But Rudy Giuliani has been making trips to Ukraine for many years as well. And President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, also has Ukraine connections. So I've been interested in the country for a while.
So in the latest episode of Trump, Inc., we kind of get the origin story to the relationship between Trump and Ukraine. It starts, as you say, with Paul Manafort and the former president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. When he was running, Yanukovych was kind of the oligarch's candidate, the oligarchs being the richest and most influential businessmen in the country. And when he began that campaign, most Ukrainians didn't support him. You mentioned in your podcast that it was Manafort who basically turned that around.
Manafort did polling. He tested messages. He got Yanukovych, who previously spoke coarsely and had assault and robbery convictions in his past, to wear a good suit, get a good haircut, and speak Ukrainian. Because he was from eastern Ukraine, he spoke Russian. In 2010, the oligarch's man won the presidency.
So Paul Manafort was helping Yanukovych to the tune, we later learn, of some $13 million on the black books. How does all this play, though, into Trump's relationship with Yanukovych?
Well, Trump doesn't really have one particularly, except that Paul Manafort's exit from Trump's campaign has kind of haunted him ever since. What we've learned over the past 10 days, really over the past many months, is that Rudy Giuliani has been offering an alternative theory, and it is, I think, a conspiracy theory, which is that the evidence that shows that Paul Manafort accepted payments from a Ukrainian strongman in the form of this black ledger was faked. What they really want to say is that instead of Russia interfering in the 2016 presidential election in Trump's favor, I should say, it was Ukraine intervening in that same election in Hillary's favor.
Right, and that's what Giuliani is going around and telling a lot of the media is happening. So let's turn to the Bidens, Joe and his son Hunter. You sat down with two journalists in Kyiv. One of them was Aubrey Belford. He's been reporting on this. And he said he originally started looking into the Biden business after he read an article in The Hill about a quote-unquote scandal involving Joe Biden. Here's what Aubrey told you about that story.
And I thought, wow, this looks like a real scandal. I'm going to investigate it. And my investigation lasted for about 30 minutes because the story just fell apart.
So, Ilya, how did that story fall apart? Because this is the story that Trump and Giuliani are pretty obsessed with, right?
Yeah. So bear with me because it's a little bit complicated. When he was vice president, Joe Biden had a special responsibility for Ukraine as a country in transition, as a country trying to adopt more openness and democracy. In that same time, his son Hunter Biden was hired to work for an energy company called Burisma. Now, at some point, Joe Biden pressured the Ukrainians to fire their general prosecutor, sort of the equivalent of the U.S. Attorney General. And the Ukrainians did fire their general prosecutor. The idea that's been put out there is that this firing was some kind of favor to Hunter Biden and Burisma, the company he was working for. All of my conversations and everything that I've read from reputable sources shows the opposite to be true. That general prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, was not investigating Burisma, the energy company. In fact, he wasn't investigating a lot of companies and individuals who deserved to be investigated for Ukraine's rampant corruption problems. That's why Joe Biden pressed for Shokin to be fired. And Joe Biden didn't do it by himself. The Europeans were also pressuring for that to happen. Lots of Western institutions also said that that prosecutor should go. So the idea that Rudy's been putting out there that it was some kind of special favor for Hunter Biden just has no support in fact.
Zooming out still further, disinformation has been a major thread here in the U.S. How does this play out in Ukraine? Is fake news becoming a way to simply just counter all these allegations?
Yeah, I mean, fake news is like not even a new concept there. I had one acquaintance there who has this expression, you can take half of that, which at first I thought she meant take it with a grain of salt. What take half of that means is take whatever somebody just said to be half true, but you don't know which half of it is true. It's a confusing information environment to operate in. But frankly, we in the United States are in that same environment too.
That's Ilya Marritz, co-host of WNYC Studio and ProPublica's podcast, Trump Inc. Their new episode is called Ukraine. We'll link to it at theworld.org. With the impeachment showdown here in the U.S., Russian President Vladimir Putin seems to be reveling in the moment. That's because it's Ukraine at the center of attention, not Russia. In Moscow today, Putin spoke on a panel at the Russian Energy Week conference, where NBC correspondent Keir Simmons asked the Russian president a simple question.
Is Russia, as Robert Mueller alleged, attempting to influence the 2020 elections in the United States?
Putin took a moment, providing a dramatic pause, and then he whispered into the microphone. I'll tell you a secret, Putin said. Yes, we'll definitely do it. Just don't tell anyone, okay? I guess that's Putin being funny. He went on to say that Russia was being pulled into this American political fight, even though it did not meddle in U.S. affairs. Putin said that this new chapter about Ukraine just proves his point. Trump's opponents are using anything they can to attack him. Last time it was Russia, Putin said. This time it's Ukraine. Harvard University can continue to consider race as one factor in the admissions process. That's the heart of yesterday's ruling by a federal judge in a closely watched affirmative action case. The decision could have implications for higher education across the U.S. The plaintiffs had argued that Harvard was intentionally discriminating against Asian Americans and using race as a predominant factor in admissions. We're going to untangle the implications here, but first we wanted to speak with someone at the center of it all. When Jang Li started as a freshman at Harvard, he hadn't even heard about the legal case or even about affirmative action. By last fall, as a senior, Li was steeped in the debate about who gets into college and why. He was also part of a lawsuit to support Harvard's admissions policy.
I'm extremely excited and happy by the ruling. I'm happy that the court reaffirmed the necessity of affirmative action for a diverse student body.
So you back Harvard and its policy. How did you get to this point, Jang, of publicly putting yourself out there in this case?
I was actually looped in through my roommate, Tang. And so Tang was actually one of the students who testified for the trial. And so he was a really close friend. And so he was getting involved. And I first started doing my own personal research and sort of learned how this whole issue of affirmative action tied to issues of equity and issues for Asian Americans around the nation.
And how did you get to that point almost as an activist? I mean, tell me more about yourself and where you grew up.
So I was born in Korea and I immigrated to Texas when I was 5 years old. And I went to high school in a predominantly white suburb. So I think growing up, I had to never really critically think about what it means to be Asian American, to really contextualize my racial identity within, I think, a broader landscape of like being Black or just being a person of color in America.
Were these things that you discussed with your parents?
Definitely not. I think as an immigrant, there was also just the language barriers. I actually did not tell my parents that I was getting involved with a case until like a year after. So it's definitely been a process.
So Harvard, you believe, is committed to diversity, and I live in the neighborhood in Cambridge and see that commitment mm-hmm. when I walk across campus. But like, how would you know that there would not be more truly qualified Asian students applying and getting rejected if they're not there?
I can tell you from my experience as an Asian American student that I believe diversity is a fundamental part of the college experience. I think questions like that sort of set the conversation around Asian American applicants versus Black applicants versus other applicants of color. But I think my question is, why are we not talking about the legacy admits? Why are we not talking about the system of recruited athletes or wealthy donors? Basically, this back door where wealthy, predominantly white students are getting into Harvard. I think there are different systems that we need to be critically thinking about rather than just asking questions of, oh, like, how do we actually know, like, theoretically, if more Asian American students were on campus?
It sounds like the Harvard community was very supportive of your position. But what about your experience outside campus with other Asian American friends and maybe back home? What kind of tension have you experienced?
I think a lot of Asian Americans tend to side with dismantling affirmative action because they think that it hurts them. But I've been able to have, I think, constructive and great conversations with friends, talking to them about how, yes, like racism for Asian Americans is real, like discrimination is real, but having race-blind admissions policies are not the solution.
Jang, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
That's Jang Lee, a recent graduate of Harvard who was active in the case to support Harvard University's admissions policies. Yesterday's court ruling raises all sorts of questions about the role of race and identity in higher education. Kirk Carapeza is a higher education reporter with WGBH here in Boston. You spoke with a group that filed the lawsuit representing an anonymous group of Asian American applicants. Who led that lawsuit and what was their reaction to this week's ruling?
Yeah, the group is called Students for Fair Admissions, and it represents this group of anonymous Asian American plaintiffs. The group claims that Harvard intentionally and systematically discriminates against Asian American applicants by holding them to higher personal and academic qualities. After the judge handed down her decision yesterday, we spoke with Edward Bloom. He's the longtime critic of the consideration of race in college admissions. He backed the lawsuit, and he says he's disappointed by the decision.
The documents, emails, data, the analysis, and the depositions that Students for Fair Admissions presented at trial compellingly revealed Harvard's systematic discrimination against Asian Americans.
So Edward Bloom is the public face of this case. There were no Asian American students publicly
That's right.
testifying against Harvard, though. Why is that?
Bloom told me the fact that Asian American plaintiffs remained anonymous in this case did not affect the outcome.
Putting the students on the stand would have perhaps jeopardized their personal safety.
Marco, we should point out that in previous cases, in like Brown versus the Board of Education, Linda Brown did put herself on the line. Bloom told me that he thinks we live in a different age with social media and that these students would have been subject to harassment.
In the end, the arguments that Bloom and his group put forward alleging discrimination against Asian American students, that did not cut it with the judge yesterday. What was at the core of her decision?
So the judge says that Harvard's admissions process is lawful. Harvard does not discriminate against Asian American applicants. She says the process is not perfect, but the court will not, quote, dismantle a very fine program solely because it could do better.
Kirk Carapeza, higher education reporter with WGBH here in Boston. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. 1 year ago today, the well-known Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi walked into Saudi Arabia's consulate building in Istanbul. He never walked out because a team of Saudi Arabian agents was there waiting to kill him. You've probably heard the details of his murder and dismemberment that day. But there's more to Jamal Khashoggi than his death. He was an insightful voice, a voice that our newsroom called on several times. One of those conversations took place almost exactly 2 years ago. The World's Carol Hills picks up the story.
In 2017, I got in touch with Jamal Khashoggi to ask about a crackdown on intellectuals that was then going on in Saudi Arabia. Hi, Jamal. It's Carol Hills in Boston.
Hello, Carol.
And I'm pronouncing you Jamal Khashoggi. Is that correct?
To my American friends, I say Khashoggi. It is actually Khashoggi, but that would be very hard to say. Khashoggi is good.
This was September of 2017. Jamal Khashoggi had recently left his native Saudi Arabia and relocated to Northern Virginia. He'd spent 30 years as a journalist all over the Middle East. Here's a few notes about his career. He went to college in Indiana. He started out as a reporter for the English-language Saudi Gazette newspaper. He would go on to report or edit for half a dozen other Saudi-owned publications. Khashoggi was one of only a few reporters to ever interview Osama bin Laden, who grew up in Saudi Arabia. That's why on September 11, 2001, he fielded so many calls from the Western press. He was an editor at a newspaper in Riyadh at the time. And on the few occasions when he wasn't working for a paper, he was a media advisor for two Saudi princes. The Jordanian journalist Salome Nemet says Khashoggi was actually close to the royal family.
He was trying to, you know, walk this fine line between being critical, at the same time a loyalist opposition.
Nemet and Khashoggi were friends and colleagues from way back.
Throughout a period of 9 years, we were working at the same newspaper, and of course because of the nature of our beat.
They both were editors for the pan-Arab newspaper Al-Hayat. They collaborated on stories and stayed in touch when Nemet moved to Washington, D.C. Khashoggi stayed on in the Middle East, where he had a unique role as both a Saudi insider and an independent journalist. His coverage of extremism and religion in the Saudi kingdom got him fired more than once.
He was always pushing the envelope. He's always trying to, you know, get the Saudi government to open up more.
Nemet says Khashoggi's interest in social and political reform was well known.
You know, he was trying always to push for a recognition of the mainstream moderate Islamist movements, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, and distinguish them from extremist groups.
Khashoggi had once been a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Though he lost interest in their more radical goals, he retained their zeal for political reform, something that some Saudi royals found threatening. But Nemet says Khashoggi also had friends and protectors in the House of Saud.
For decades, they tolerated the fact that he was sympathetic to the Islamist movement, not apologetic to any extremist group. They considered him a loyalist. And so things went on until the rise of Mohammed bin Salman.
The crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, better known as MBS. He was barely 30 years old when he became crown prince in 2017. And when I spoke with Jamal Khashoggi just 3 months later, he told me that he respected Mohammed bin Salman's progressive agenda.
He wants to push for economic reform, open up the country, allow young people to enjoy entertainment, curb radicalism. We support him in all of that.
But Khashoggi clearly saw a darker side of the new Saudi order. He left the country the same month MBS came to power. By September, he was writing for the Washington Post, and that's when I interviewed him. Mr. Khashoggi, the title of your article was Saudi Arabia Wasn't Always This Repressive, Now It's Unbearable. What prompted you to write it?
A number of things. Arrest, mass arrest, which we never witnessed before. A campaign, a hate campaign, an intimidation against writers, intellectuals. That prompted me to say something, because this is not the direction I was hoping my country to take.
Salome Nemet says Khashoggi knew he could not write freely in Saudi Arabia under the new regime.
Yeah, Mohammed bin Salman did not want anybody who was operating independently, especially at a sensitive time when he was trying to build up his image in the West, because he's preparing to be the next king.
In our interview, Khashoggi told me about the mix of excitement and trepidation that greeted the crown prince's plans for Saudi Arabia's future.
People are willing to support his reform plans, and these reform plans are going to be painful because they're going to address economic matters, unemployment, and that requires unity, not division. But what we have right now is division. Saudis targeting other Saudis. Saudis hating other Saudis.
In Khashoggi's first column for the Washington Post, he went public about the detention of 30 Saudi intellectuals who'd written critically about MBS and its policies. He wrote about the close advisor of the crown prince who'd launched a social media campaign to silence dissent. His name is Saad al-Qahtani. And Khashoggi wrote about him again when Qahtani started a blacklist, a program to have Saudis report on other Saudis for being disloyal.
So Prince Mohammed bin Salman is kind of spying on people or having people keep track of who is writing negatively about him?
I'm not saying Prince Mohammed bin Salman is doing that. No, it's not him. It's not him. But this is happening under his watch. It is not him who's spying. It's not him who's intimidating. But this is happening under his watch. And I urge him to stop it. He needs to stop that.
I want to go back to your situation. Will you be able to go home to Saudi Arabia?
No. In principle, I can, but of course, I will risk being arrested or being banned from travel, and that will be very suffocating.
Over the next year, he settled into his new life. He wrote prolifically. He made plans to get married. He traveled to Turkey to see his fiancée and get some important documents from the Saudi consulate there.
He was last seen on Tuesday entering Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, seeking paperwork to marry his fiancée.
This closed-circuit camera footage is the last known sight of him.
It was really shocking. I could not believe that actually it happened. I did not want to believe that it was true.
This is Salome Nemet again, Khashoggi's longtime friend and colleague. Like many people who knew Khashoggi, he held out hope that his friend would reappear.
But, you know, on the second day, I started thinking, that's it. You know, he's gone. One way or the other, he's gone. Either kidnapped, not to be seen again like other opposition Saudi figures. You know, the saddest part is that they didn't need to do that. Jamal was not someone who was out there to join forces with the crazy extremist Islamists who want to finish off the Saudi monarchy. He was being critical for the sake of Saudi Arabia, not against Saudi Arabia.
On this anniversary of Khashoggi's death, I keep remembering one of the last things we talked about in our interview 2 years ago. You end your Washington Post article by admitting that you'd kept silent when friends were arrested. You were afraid of losing your job or endangering your family. Why did you make a different choice this week?
Because I'm free here, and I will feel very much bad, very much guilty, if I continue in enjoying my life, being silent when I can't speak.
That's the irony about this Saudi journalist who wouldn't keep quiet, who left the country that he loved so that he could be free to talk about it. A year after his death in Istanbul, everybody is still talking about Jamal Khashoggi. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
That story was produced by The World's Stephen Snyder. You can hear Carol's full interview with Jamal Khashoggi and see a transcript at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. North Korea just conducted another missile test. Experts say it might be the type of weapon that's launched from a submarine.
Our understanding of the North Korean submarine is that it's relatively primitive compared to the kind that the United States has.
The View from South Korea, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The announcement from North Korea of yet another ballistic missile test did not come out of the blue, but it is a big concern, coming as it does in a worrying sequence of other tests. If you go back to last year, North Korea only staged one missile test in 2018 on November 15th. Then those tests went dark for several months. The second U.S.-North Korea summit happened in February in Hanoi. Those talks with Kim Jong-un ended after Trump walked away. And then on May 4th, Pyongyang staged another missile test. And again on May 9th. July 25th. And four more. Today's test was especially alarming because the flight path suggested it was a missile designed to be launched from a submarine. That's a concern because ground launches are easy to see. A submarine launch is not. James Kim is a fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, South Korea. He has doubts about North Korea's submarine program.
As far as we know, our understanding of the North Korean submarine is that it's relatively primitive compared to the kind that the United States has. So we don't believe that they have the ability to travel lengthy distance. But nonetheless, you can never underestimate your adversary.
It's interesting. I mean, North Korea staged this missile test just a few days before another round of U.S.-North Korea talks. What is Kim Jong-un's strategy here, and what kind of message is he sending by going to a submarine-launched system?
I think he's sending a very strong message that he's trying to get an advantage, some leverage leading up to the working level negotiations. Essentially, they're calling the time, they're calling the terms under which these negotiations will take place. Clearly, we saw the failure in Hanoi earlier this year. The North Korean demands for complete sanctions relief in exchange for marginal movements towards denuclearization was not going to be acceptable for President Trump. But perhaps the North Koreans may be willing to settle for something less than that. And they've recently stated that they're more interested in security guarantees for the regime than their interest in lowering sanctions. So it sounds like the North Koreans' positions have shifted a bit.
With John Bolton out as national security advisor and an acting advisor in the White House, what weaknesses do you see in Trump's North Korean negotiation team? I mean, is there a likelihood that they just might settle?
There's a possibility here for a smaller interim deal that could be a stepping stone towards a larger deal where both sides can build confidence and trust in each other. So I wouldn't discount the possibility of marginal changes here where both sides can gain something. But this is very different than the kind of deal that the Trump administration had been talking about with John Bolton in the White House. He was calling for a deal that would lead to a complete denuclearization. So we'll have to wait and see how the talks pan out.
Where is South Korean President Moon Jae-in with all of this? I mean, what options are available to him in South Korea right now with Trump and Kim continuing this back and forth?
Well, President Moon so far has reached out to the North Koreans, but the North Koreans have not been very receptive to President Moon's overtures ever since the Hanoi talks failed. So President Moon has only President Trump here who he can work with. And he's had a couple of meetings with President Trump to, you know, further coordinate and work with the Americans to see what the South Koreans can do, if anything at all, to encourage the North Koreans to show up for these talks. During the last UN General Assembly meeting, President Moon suggested the possibility of demining the demilitarized zone. And it's interesting that it was after his speech that the North Koreans have made this move to announce a working level meeting. So did his statement have any impact on this? I don't know, but it did precede this latest announcement.
James, it sounds like you're taking this all in stride there in Seoul. How worrying do you see this latest news personally?
Well, you know, we have not had a second Korean War after the signing of the armistice, and the U.S. troops are still here. Regardless of what President Trump has said, there's 28,500 American soldiers here. The bureaucrats at the State Department and the Defense Department is reassuring the South Koreans that U.S. extended deterrence guarantees are still in place and is robust. So we don't see much change here in terms of the overall situation. As far as the U.S.-South Korean alliance is concerned, it's still in place. It's still working. As long as that doesn't change, putting aside some of these tests that every now and then North Korea conducts, I think the South Koreans have a relatively good feeling about the state of the alliance and the ability to deter any North Korean provocations.
James Kim, a fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, thanks very much for your perspective.
Thanks for having me.
For many people in South Korea, the thing at the top of their list of daily concerns is not North Korea. It's the South Korean economy. It's slowing down, and one clear sign of that is the number of karaoke rooms that are closing their doors. They're called norebang in Korean, and they're going out of business in record numbers. But it's not just the economy that's quieting the karaoke scene. As Jason Strother reports from Seoul, it may also have something to do with a shift in Korean workplace culture.
When you enter a norebang, you walk right into a wall of sound. It pours out of several private rooms where groups of friends and co-workers belt out ballads. In Korea, you go to karaoke rooms to sing with people you already know, unlike in America, where karaoke often means humiliating yourself in front of total strangers.
I would rather sing in front of my friends rather than strangers. Like that's I feel like to me it's kind of awkward situation, so I won't sing in front of the strangers at all.
I tagged along with Jin Kyuan and some of her friends to a local noraebang. She's 24.
If I don't sing well, my friends are singing together with me, so I feel like I have backups.
This room comfortably fits six people on sofas. There are surround sound speakers and a large screen TV. On a table, two wireless mics, a keypad for the karaoke machine, and two tambourines for backup percussion. Jin types in a song. A disco globe lights up. Lyrics appear on the screen, and Jin picks up a mic. While Jin and her friends are having fun in this room, the noraebang's owner, Myung-ho Ki, waits in the lobby for more customers. She says it's not easy to run this place now because the economy is bad. Myung says in the past year, she's lost about half of her customers, but she thinks things will get better and she won't have to close down. But many other noraebang are closing down, about 1,400 across South Korea in the past year. That's according to a South Korean research group, which also reports a record low in new openings of karaoke rooms. And it attributes the decrease to recent changes in Korean office party culture. After our team-building outings called Hweishik are an integral part of Korean work life. Typically, a boss takes his staff out on the company card for dinner and drinks, followed by hours of karaoke in a noraebang where the drinking continues. And that can put some employees in uncomfortable situations, especially women.
In noraebang, it's not only for singing.
I spoke with a 39-year-old government worker who asked to go by her surname, Jun.
Sometimes there's forced blues time that you sometimes have to dance with your boss or your colleagues. The body was very close to each other, and that was very unpleasant.
She says pretty much every Korean woman she knows has experienced this situation at a noraebang hweishik.
Sometimes you feel it's a little bit of sexual harassment. I don't know if I can put it that way, but I felt that way sometimes.
Jun says in the past, she felt like she couldn't refuse her senior male colleagues, but now she says she doesn't feel as pressured anymore. Lee Teha, who runs a PR firm and monitors business trends, says young employees are becoming more comfortable voicing their complaints about excess drinking in karaoke rooms. He says it's partly because of a new anti-harassment law that gives workers the power to refuse their bosses outside of the office, and another new rule. Companies can no longer force staff to work more than 52 hours per week, down from 68. Lee says Koreans are more focused on improving work-life balance, and more bosses, like him, respect that.
Because some people do not want to spend more time. They want to go back home. And some people do not drink a lot. Some people do not sing well.
He says instead of noraebang and booze, his office parties now might involve dinner and a movie and wrap up with a coffee at a reasonable hour, like 10 p.m. Lee tells me he still enjoys singing karaoke. This song from the 70s is his favorite, but now he does it on his own time with his family and friends. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
As we mentioned earlier, it's exactly 1 year today since Jamal Khashoggi walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get papers for his upcoming marriage. He never came out. Intelligence agencies have linked his murder to the highest levels of the Saudi government, but the Trump administration is still pursuing warm diplomatic relations with the kingdom. Khashoggi's friends and colleagues see this as a betrayal of his memory. He was one of many journalists living in exile in Istanbul. And as Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul, Khashoggi's death is both a personal loss and a reminder of the risks the exiled journalists face.
The Saudi consulate is this yellow building with a high wall and razor wire. There's a park and a grocery store across the street. The glass skyscrapers of Istanbul's banking district kind of rise in the distance. About a year ago, these sidewalks were filled with cameras and journalists, first as they waited for information on what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, and later as his colleagues and friends gathered to protest his killing. Many of them, like Khashoggi, who live here because of threats from their own governments. I took the metro for an hour into an outer suburb of Istanbul, and I visited the studios of El Shark TV, a station owned by a former Egyptian politician now living in exile. A presenter named Sami Kamal al-Din is about to go on air for an evening program called El Shari al-Musri, the Egyptian Street. The viewers are Egyptian, the politics are Egyptian. But the journalists are sitting in a studio in Turkey. On air, Kamal al-Din veers between humor and outrage, sometimes speaking to Egypt's dictator, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, directly. The idea is to cover the topics that matter to people, when most of the news in Egypt is aligned with the government. Today, he and his co-host focus on a new wave of corruption claims against Sisi. A series of YouTube videos from a government contractor turned whistleblower have set off protests in Egypt, some of the first since a military takeover in 2013. In Egypt, political commentary like this could mean imprisonment or worse. Kamal al-Din had to leave the country himself in 2013. That's when he met Jamal Khashoggi.
جمال خاشقجي كنت أعرفه كاتب في الحياة والشرق الأوسط وأقرأ كتبه قبل الخروج من مصر.
Before he knew Khashoggi, Kamal al-Din says, he knew his work. For many young people who hoped for democracy and human rights during the Arab Spring uprisings, Khashoggi supported a version of reform that was gradual, even moderate, Kamal al-Din says.
My brother, my friend, جمال خاشقجي.
They met while working in Qatar. Both had a fondness for Cuban cigars, which they would smoke together in the Sheraton Hotel and discuss politics.
كان جمال خاشقجي يستمع أكثر مما يتكلم يعني يعطي الناس فرصة أولا.
Khashoggi would listen more than he would speak, Kamal al-Din says. He had a way of making people feel at ease, giving them the space to talk. He went through life with the heart of a poet.
أهل مكة أضرب شعابها في كل القضايا.
On October 3rd, the day after Khashoggi disappeared, Kamal al-Din got a call from a Turkish source saying Jamal wasn't just missing, he had been murdered. Kamal al-Din says he had a complete breakdown. He couldn't stop crying. Not just because of Khashoggi. It seemed like this could have happened to any dissident journalist in exile. Kamal al-Din says he pulled himself together, confirmed the tip, and reported his friend's death. Out of duty, he says. But even today, he won't walk inside his own consulate.
I'm afraid.
Analysts say these concerns are widespread and completely valid.
This is not unique to Jamal. There are hundreds and hundreds of journalists and civil society activists who are being hounded and jailed and tortured and sometimes killed or disappeared.
Rami Khoury is a journalism professor at the American University in Beirut, and he also had a personal friendship with Khashoggi. When autocrats hound journalists and force them out of the country, he says, it creates a mediocre, docile news corps in the places where it's needed most.
The problem is a problem in the Arab world, but there are complicit governments all over the Western world, especially, who speak about democracy and freedom and human rights, but happily support autocrats.
Jamal is a symbol of a much bigger problem, Khoury says, but he paid for it with his life. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin, Istanbul, Turkey.
Imagine you're a professor and you get your dream job at a prestigious university. That's what happened to Amber Murray when last year she was hired as an associate professor in geography at Oxford University in the UK. Murray is American, so are her daughters, ages 4 and 9. When she applied to get them visas to come to the UK, the applications were rejected. Some say this is part of a larger trend that the UK is making it more difficult for foreign academics to work there. Murray says her rejection came down to the fact that her husband doesn't live in the UK. He works in Cameroon, and UK immigration law has strict rules about parents in their situation trying to get visas for their children.
It states that the other parent should be deceased or the parent residing in the UK should have and should have had unique responsibility for the children, or that there should be compelling reasons and the parent residing in the UK should have taken efforts to ensure the well-being of their children. And so we've applied under the final caveat and, you know, supplied all of the necessary documentation, including a legal document from my husband specifying that this is in the best interest of the children at this time.
So that rejection came from the UK's Home Office. What were you feeling when you read that letter?
Well, when I received it, shock and dismay, and then, of course, incredible sorrow. I just broke down.
Where are your daughters at the moment, and how did they take the news?
My family now is in the U.S., and they were shocked. Of course, they don't understand. My 9-year-old took it very badly and sobbed the entire day leading up to my departure and begged me at the airport not to go and just, you know, doesn't understand any of this.
That's a tough one. Were you at all thinking maybe I shouldn't go?
Absolutely. The self-doubt has been with me this entire time.
And you're not the only academic trying to work in the UK who's had to deal with a visa rejection or other immigration issues. Are you getting a sense of a trend here?
Absolutely. The sort of response that I've received from Anna Fraser-Ackerley's article in The Guardian has been overwhelming. And, you know, even today I received an email from a PhD student also at the University of Oxford whose 9-year-old son was also refused entry for precisely the same reason. And again, there were compelling circumstances in that case that were disregarded.
Right. So that Guardian article about your case, I mean, was pretty widely read, obviously. Has Oxford offered any help?
There's an immigration team here. I think they're very careful to get involved, and especially when it's not, you know, the employee's visa, they give informal guidance. And of course, I have letters of support from my head of department and from the principal of my college. And I have very supportive colleagues, but other than that, not at this time.
Is there a way for you to appeal?
Yes, there's an administrative review, and we're working on submitting those documents tomorrow.
So what will you do if this does not get resolved?
That's a great question. I'm feeling overwhelmed already by all of this. And I will just have to have a conversation with my husband and think very seriously about the next steps. Obviously looking for work outside of the UK if that's necessary.
Was this a temporary position or was it essentially permanent?
This is the American equivalent of a tenure track position.
Wow. Amber Murray, an associate professor in geography at Oxford University in the UK. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time, Marco.
It's been nearly 1 month since Hurricane Dorian wreaked havoc on the Bahamas. The storm killed more than 50 people, hundreds more missing. Some communities were completely wiped out. Among the aid groups that have responded was a team from Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. They arrived on the island of Grand Bahama early last month. Among them was Dr. Myron Roll. He's a third-year neurosurgery resident whose family is from the Bahamas. Roll spoke with my colleague Joe Matthew here at WGBH, and he described what it was like to see such devastation in a place many of his family members still call home.
It was very difficult to compartmentalize my emotions. You know, at first I said, well, I got to go back home. I got to, you know, take care of my family. I have to do something. And then the other side of me was like, well, this is going to be devastating. I mean, it's going to hit me hard just being in Boston and trying to, you know, perfect my craft as a neurosurgeon, but then going home and seeing the destruction that I've never seen before. When I'm seeing the pictures and all my friends are telling me about it, and then my family is kind of coming in by piecemeal telling me that they're okay, it was just a mix of emotions.
Dr. Roll said healthcare is going to be one of the biggest challenges for people in the Bahamas. Some of it has to do with the geography of the islands, not just the damage from the hurricane.
I remember as a child, you know, we would have a doctor that would come through the island and my parents would take us and they would say, you tell them every single thing that happened to you for the last month. Like, you don't leave anything out because you never know when that doctor's going to come back. So with an already sort of disjointed and disconnected medical infrastructure outside of Nassau, the capital, you know, and then you put this kind of hurricane that can even further separate or further exacerbate that problem, it makes it hard.
In the aftermath of the storm, officials are treating injuries, sickness, and mental health issues. They also have to make sure people with chronic conditions are getting the care they need. Dr. Roll said there's hope that in rebuilding, there may even be opportunities for improvements.
There's an example of CT scanners and MRI scanners that are being donated from LA from a group that I know back down to the Bahamas. That's better than the stuff that we have now or that we had. And so, you know, just if we can continue to move forward and continue to try to solve some of these gaps in our healthcare system with the help of the international aid and international community, that would be a wonderful thing.
One more item on Dr. Roll's resume. He's also an NFL veteran, formerly on the roster of the Tennessee Titans. But Roll says his family is more impressed by his aid work.
Football is not so huge back home, but yeah, they're very proud, and it makes me happy to make them proud for sure.
Dr. Myron Roll, a neurosurgery resident at Mass General Hospital. You heard him speaking with my colleague Joe Matthew with WGBH News here in Boston. And that'll do it for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll be back with us tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.